This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
To keep you in suspense.
I had a be everyday grind.
Night transmissions.
Hello and welcome to the 87th edition of Night Transmissions. I'm sure most of you know exactly what's going on by now, and those of you who don't will learn soon enough. Unlike most episodes of the show, I'm not going to take advantage of a few moments at the top of the show to just prattle on completely randomly, making no sense at all, but we're going to get into it really quick. The first segment is an episode of The Crime Club, which aired originally on April the 20th of 1947, called Dead Man Control. The Crime Club was produced and directed by Willis Cooper, whose name you may remember in connection with a couple of seminal radio programs, those being Lights Out and Quiet Please. It ran in 1946 and 1947 and featured murder and mystery stories. It shares its name with an imprint for crime novels published by Doubleday. There's not really any evidence of any kind of commercial relationship between Mutual, the producing network for Crime Club, and Doubleday. But most of the stories were adaptations from the Doubleday series. The series of books was more successful than the radio show. The imprint began in 1926 and will continue to publish until 1991.
Hello, I hope I haven't kept you waiting. Yes, this is the Crime Club. I'm the librarian. Dead Man Control. Yes, we have that Crime Club story for you. Come right over. Take the easy chair by the window.
Comfortable?
The book is on this shelf. Here it is. Dead Man Control by Helen Riley. The very absorbing story of a murder in which Cupid held the hand of death. Let's look at it under the reading lamp. It was late morning, and in the library of a mansion on East 67th Street, multimillionaire Fenimore Kingston was standing before the wall safe he had just opened. He smiled, and then as he reached in... 2 hours later, Inspector Christopher McKee was in his office at police headquarters on Center Street when the telephone rang.
Inspector McKee talking, Homicide Bureau.
Good morning. This is Catherine Kingston.
Yes?
Mrs. Fenimore Kingston.
Oh, yes?
My husband's been murdered. Can you come?
Where?
Our home is on East 67th Street.
All right, I'll be there in 20 minutes.
Yes?
Cassidy, order my car. We're going uptown.
Yes, sir. And how are you...
And don't stop to ask about anybody's health. I'm in a hurry. Please go on, Mrs. Kingston.
Well, Inspector, as soon as I saw that open wall safe, I thought my husband had been killed by a burglar.
Mm-hmm.
So while I was waiting for you, I checked the contents. The money and the bonds were still there. But...
Yes?
The diamond ring that Fenimore gave me after our wedding 3 months ago. That's gone.
That wouldn't be the well-publicized Kingston diamond, would it?
It would, Inspector. And it's worth $500,000.
Yes, but the cash on those negotiable bonds...
I can't understand why they weren't taken, too.
Very unusual thief, to say the least. Where were you when the miracle happened?
Out. I went out early this morning. I was restless.
Why?
I was tired of doing nothing. So I took the car and drove until I was tired of driving.
Alone?
Inspector McKee.
Don't be alarmed, Mrs. Kingston. I'm not insinuating...
But your tone...
Merely professional. Now, according to the medical examiner, your husband was shot in the back and death was instantaneous about 2 hours ago. Who was in the house with him then?
I don't know.
What about the servants? Did they go out driving too?
We have no servants.
In this big house?
They quit last night.
Oh?
Don't let it surprise you, Inspector. Fenimore was not an easy person to get along with.
Mrs. Kingston... For your special information, I don't let anything surprise me.
Excuse me, sir.
What is it, Cassidy?
It's about the murder weapon.
Did you find it?
No, sir. There ain't a trace of it in the house. Me and the boys have looked in every nook and...
All right, Cassidy. All right.
Yes, sir.
Oh, my. What's the matter?
Over there, Inspector. Peep it out from under that corner of the window drape. It shines like a diamond.
It is a diamond.
Well, if it is, then the saints preserve us. It must be as big as an eyeball.
Yes. Well, Mrs. Kingston.
My ring.
No burglary, huh?
It doesn't seem so, does it? But how did that ring get under the drape?
The law of gravity. It fell when your husband fell, after he was shot. And it either rolled or bounced. You can take your pick.
I'll take the ring, if you don't mind.
Later. Right now, it's evidence.
But it's mine.
We'll take good care of it. Come on, Cassidy.
I'll be finished here, sir.
For the time being, goodbye, Mrs. Kingston.
Goodbye, Inspector.
Cassidy.
Inspector McKee, if it's one question I might ask...
Go ahead.
What's the ring got to do with the cadaver we carried upstairs?
I think it killed him.
The deputy say.
Don't lead me on, Sergeant. I've no time to explain.
Right, if you say so, Inspector.
Going back to my office. I want you to go to the telephone company. Get a list of every call that's been made from or to this house in the last 2 days. Report to me at headquarters.
Yes, sir. But there's one thing that...
Now what?
It's that girl in there, Mrs. Kingston.
Uh-huh.
Now, I've been on the force for 32 years, and it's a fine education I've got about the good and the bad in
Not
people.
Not now, Cassidy.
When a girl, young and beautiful, marries a man twice her age and a millionaire, she didn't marry him for love.
Is this Michael Dolger's apartment?
Yes.
Who is this?
Amy Cloverson. Why?
This is Catherine Kingston. Let me talk to Michael, please.
You might ask me how I'm feeling.
Please, Amy.
After all, you did get what I wanted.
I want to speak to Michael.
I'll ask him how he feels about it. Hold the wire. Don't wind it too tightly around your neck, dear.
Hello, Kathy.
What's she doing there?
Oh, she just dropped in for a cocktail.
Oh, it doesn't matter. I want you to meet me right away.
Where?
Central Park, inside the 72nd Street entrance. I'll pick you up in my car.
All right. What's the rumpus about?
Fenimore's dead.
What did you say?
He was murdered this morning.
Good grief. Maybe I'd better come over.
No. The police are here, dozens of them, all over the place. Meet me in half an hour. And come alone.
How'd you manage it?
I didn't.
What?
I couldn't get out without being seen. Michael, I'm in trouble.
But if the police followed you...
Is that all you care about? Your precious hide?
Well, it's the only one I've got.
Well, you don't have to worry. I wasn't followed.
Are you sure?
Yes, look for yourself. Is there a police car behind us?
No, but...
Michael, really, I'm in serious trouble.
How was Fenimore killed?
He was shot. And the police think I did it.
You? Have they said so?
Well, not in words, they haven't. That Inspector McKee, he thinks he's very clever.
Oh, you should have left me alone, Kathy.
I couldn't. I had to speak to you.
Now, why didn't you do it on the phone?
I didn't want to incriminate you.
What?
Suppose one of those policemen had been listening at the door.
Well, suppose.
He'd have heard me asking you about that appointment you had with Fenimore this morning.
That I had?
Just about the time he was killed.
Now, wait a minute. I had no appointment with Fenimore.
That's not the truth. He phoned you and asked you to come over.
Did he tell you that?
No.
Then how do you know so much?
I was listening in on the upstairs extension.
Oh. How much did you hear?
He wanted you to meet him at the house at 11 o'clock. It was very important.
Anything else?
No, I put the receiver down. It was 10:30, and I wanted to be out of the house before you arrived.
Really?
I didn't know what he was going to talk to you about. I was afraid it might be us.
So you ran away. That's too bad.
Why?
Because if you'd stayed, you'd have learned something.
Didn't he talk to you about us?
No, dear.
Well, then what did he?
I don't know. I wasn't there.
What?
That's right. Fenimore wanted to see me, but I didn't want to see him, and I told him so.
You told Fenimore?
Yes, I did. The great mammoth. Or was it about time?
I'd like to believe that, Mike.
Then do. I got tired of being my cousin's errand boy and of running to him every time he beckoned.
But you're allowed.
I told him what to do with that, too. But it doesn't make any difference now, does it?
No.
You're free. And we'll have all the money we both need.
That's putting it very bluntly.
Why not? He never cared for anyone, including you. You were the most beautiful thing he ever saw, and he wanted you. It's just as simple as that.
I know all about it.
All right. All right. I'll shut up. Kathy?
Yes?
Did you really go out this morning?
I said I did.
Of course. But I was just thinking, what a wonderful opportunity you had, alone in that house with him.
Yeah? Uh-huh. Good work, Gordon. Let me know when she gets back.
Can I come in, Inspector?
Help yourself, Cassidy.
Well, I checked with the telephone company, sir, and it's big news, if I don't mind saying it myself.
Yes? Anything like Catherine Kingston going out to meet a man?
A what?
You've heard of the species, Cassidy. And I'm sure you've heard of Central Park.
Is that where she went with him?
Mm-hmm.
In broad daylight? There's no topping an Irishman, is there?
Well, not if he comes from the County Cork, sir. Who's the man?
We don't know yet, but he's being tailed.
Now, what did you find out at the telephone company?
Oh, wait. Here's a list of all the cars that came and went from the Kingston house in the last couple of days.
Right.
It's them last three that was made this morning.
Yes, all outgoing. One at 10:30, one at 10:35.
And Kingston was killed at about 11.
And this one at 1:45. Oh, 2 minutes after we left Mrs. Kingston.
That's right.
Who were these calls made to?
But I got that on another slip of paper. Now, where the... Oh, yeah, here it is. Now, the first one and the last one to Michael Dolge.
So that's the man.
Mm-hmm.
Now, go ahead, Cassidy. I'm just checking.
He was the dead man's cousin.
How do you know?
Well, I remember seeing his name in the papers after the Kingston wedding. Seems to me he was either the best man or one of the ushers.
But it's not him I'd be worrying about, sir.
No? Why not?
It's that woman. The one who got the call at 10:35.
What woman?
Amy Claubertson.
No answer. Michael Dolge, most likely out with Catherine Kingston.
Yeah.
What did you say about a woman?
Amy Claubertson.
Well, what about her?
Well, say, you know how I read the newspapers every day.
I know.
After I get through with the spotting pages, I always turn to the society page. Mm. It's an old habit of mine. I acquired it 32 years ago when I was a rookie on that Fifth Avenue beat. You know Fifth Avenue uptown where Central Park lies opposite them glorious mansions with the beautiful...
Sit down, Cassidy.
Well, thank you, sir. Them were fine old days. People used to come from all over just to look at the Woolworth building.
Don't let me interrupt you, but you were telling me about a woman.
A woman?
Yes, in connection with a murder.
Amy Claubertson. Well, so seeing her name again brought to mind a society page item of about 5 months ago.
To the effect
that Amy Claubertson and Fenimore Kingston were engaged to be married.
Cassidy, are you sure?
Yes, I am, sir, because the diamond ring was mentioned in the same article.
How?
Well, she wore it at the formal reception.
I see.
And not 2 months later, Fenimore Kingston married Catherine.
It's the old story, Inspector.
Not another one, please.
The woman scorned. There's no fury like a woman who expects to marry a millionaire and gets jilted.
Yes. Yes. There's no doubt about it. All right, I'll pick it up on the way out.
Well. Oh. Bad news, Inspector.
For someone. That was a lab just phoned. The ring we found is a phony. A perfect imitation.
You mean it's made of glass?
Not quite.
Somebody had a good job done for a few hundred dollars, and the original, valued at $500,000...
Well, it might be somewhere in a vault, maybe. Lots of people wear paste and keep their valuables locked up.
Yes, sir. Phone the Kingston House. Tell the men to turn that place inside out.
Yes, sir.
And when you get through, take as many men as you need and contact every diamond cutter in town, especially the ones around Maiden Lane.
Yes, sir.
Now, where's that slip of paper with the names on it?
It's right here, sir. The address is, too.
Give it to me. I'm going out to pay Amy Culbertson a visit. Excuse me.
I don't want any.
Inspector McKee, police.
I still don't want any, but you can come in. I have scotch on the table. Cigarettes, you didn't bring your own.
No, thanks.
Sit yourself. What do you want?
Sit down, please.
You're here to ask a lot of questions about Fenimore Kingston's murder. Don't waste your breath if you don't know any of the answers.
How do you know about his murder?
Radio told me.
Not today. Not today, Miss Robertson. Why don't you sit down?
Maybe I don't want to.
Would you have any reason to protect Catherine Kingston?
Not one. Well, here's to you.
Michael Doe? Sorry, I didn't mean to catch you off guard.
Why'd you mention his name to me?
This pack of matches with his name on the cover.
You're pretty smart, aren't you?
I have a weakness for matches that are left on tables.
All right, so he told me about Fenimore's death. I was at his apartment when Catherine phoned. She told him. Anything else you'd like to know?
What time did you meet Fenimore Kingston this morning?
I did what?
He phoned you at 10:35.
How'd you find out about that?
You just told me.
Why, you wheedling weasel.
Shall we talk now?
Pitch curves and have me swing at him.
I'd like to know about you and Fenimore Kingston.
I'm through talking to you.
Are you? Then suppose we go down to headquarters.
What for?
We're very lonesome.
Now, wait a minute. Let me go. I haven't done anything.
What about you and Kingston?
We were engaged. And then he jilted me and married that...
Yes?
Catherine and I were in the same show. I met Fenimore at a party and he fell for me like a ton of diamonds. And like a fool, I introduced him to Catherine.
Why did he phone you this morning?
One to date.
Now, look, Miss Parkinson.
That's the truth. Told me he was going to divorce Catherine. He found out about her and Michael. He thought I knew something, too.
And, of course, you rushed over to Michael's apartment and told him.
Not exactly. I tried to make it casual.
3 hours later?
Mike and I were in the same boat. Both of us had been kicked around by Fenimore. That was a common bond.
So you waited from 10:35 until almost 2.
Still pitching curves, aren't you?
Was it because you tried to get his apartment in the morning and couldn't?
No.
Or didn't you even try?
What do you want from me? I didn't kill anybody.
Fenimore didn't call you to talk about his wife.
Then I don't know what he did call me
for. He asked you about this ring.
What? Where'd you...
You wore it for a while, didn't you?
Yeah, but I gave it back.
This one?
Look, mister, there's only one of its kind in the world.
Why did he call you about it?
Because he thought...
Yes?
Nothing.
He thought you'd know a good imitation from the real thing.
You mean that diamond's a fake?
We'll find out soon enough, if you're really surprised. Goodbye, for now.
Oh, you're going?
Sorry?
Oh, I'm collapsing. Drop in again sometime. Anytime.
Thanks. And let's hope I don't have to return that invitation.
Michael.
Amy, what are you doing here?
I figured she'd drive you home. She was always the lady. Get back in the car.
Now, see here,
get
Amy.
Back or I'll make a scene that'll turn you both into mummies.
Gotta do as she says, Michael.
All right, Kathy.
I'll be right behind you, kiddies, in the back seat. Now, Catherine, who told Inspector McKee about me?
What?
About Fenimore having phoned me this morning.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Well, you know he phoned me, don't you?
No.
Oh, you couldn't tell the truth if you had a mouthful of it and it was choking.
Wait a minute, Amy.
She's trying to frame me. And she'll frame you, too.
What was Fenimore talking to you about?
Ask her. She was tuned into the extension.
Were you, Kathy?
No.
She had to be. How else...
She said no, Amy.
All right, so she said no. How did Inspector McKee know that I talked to Fenimore and about the diamond, too?
The diamond?
Yes. Maybe you didn't know that beautiful thing was just a hunk of glass.
What? That's a lie.
Well, it wasn't when Fenimore asked me about it this morning. He wanted me to return the original.
Oh, Oh, is that why you killed him?
Oh, I knew that was coming out of you. You'd like the police to think that, wouldn't you?
Maybe they already do.
Well, that wouldn't put you in the clear, Kathy, darling. I returned the original to Fenimore.
Can you prove it?
Can you prove that I didn't? Wind her up, Michael. She seems to have run down.
I think you said enough, Amy.
I'm through. And so is she. For good, I hope.
Inspector McKee, homicide.
Cassidy talking, sir.
Go ahead.
I think I found him, Inspector.
Who?
The diamond-cutting fella.
Good. What does he say about the Kingston diamond?
Well, sir, it might be the man and it might not.
What?
Well, I found him in a small room on the top floor of a small building just around the corner off Maiden Lane. There was no name on the door, just the words diamond cutting. But I took a chance
Cassidy.
Anyway. It's a good thing I did, Inspector.
No.
For there was that poor old fella stretched out on the floor, dead.
Oh, no.
A little fella he was, too. And beaten around the head unmercifully.
What's the address?
I got it written down on a piece of paper. Now, with it. Oh, yes, here it is.
It's up here, Inspector.
All right, Cassidy, I'm doing the best I can.
But I got some information, sir. I checked with some of the neighbors on this floor.
Where's the body?
I'll take you to it, sir. Well, as I was saying, I checked. And the fellow's name was Rudolf Leibnitz.
What else?
Well, that's all, sir. He came over from the other side a few years ago. A victim of war and oppression. And to think that his only reward for minding his own
business... How do you know he was minding his own business?
His reputation in the trade, the inspector, was good. He was known to all his neighbors as an honest man, a good worker, and a fine upstanding character. And when your competitors have only
praise... Is this the room, Cassidy?
Yes, sir. There he is.
Yeah.
A little old fella.
Why didn't you tell me his files had been opened and dumped?
Well, I was going to,
well,
Chief,
but... Well, it doesn't matter. Somebody wanted a record and they took it.
You think this can be an outcome of the Kingston murder?
Maybe. Let's have a look at the body.
He didn't have a chance. Struck on the back of the head and then beaten until he...
Yes?
This man's been dead since this morning. Late this morning. Would you be sure about that?
Rigor mortis takes at least 6 hours to set in. Just beginning.
Ah, then it'd be about the time Fenimore Kingston was murdered.
A little later, but not much. The killer came right from the Kingston house to this place and... All right, Cassidy, there's no point in searching the room.
No, sir.
We won't find anything.
Oh.
Hello. Hello, operator. Give me police headquarters.
Have you got a plan, sir?
I hope so, Cassidy. Hello. Give me Murphy and Homicide. Inspector McKee. I hope so, Cassidy. If it works, it'll be a miracle.
It will talk of miracles. There was a...
I want you to have the following three parties picked up. All right? Catherine Kingston, Michael Dold, and A.B. Clauberson. You'll find the addresses on my desk. Keep them in my office until I get there. Now it's for you, Cassidy.
Yes, sir.
You stay here. Phone the medical examiner's office and look after the usual details. I'm going out for a long walk.
Yes, sir.
Those people will wait, even if they don't like it. And let's hope they don't like it enough to burn.
Inspector McKee.
Well, company. How are you, Mrs. Kingston?
Why did you have me brought here? And
Miss Robertson?
I'm cheerful enough to break your neck.
And taking two from three, you must be Michael Doe.
We've been waiting for 2 hours, Inspector.
Yes. Why have you had me arrested?
It's a habit of mine, Mrs. Kingston, when a murder's been committed.
Well, then we are under arrest.
For the time being, Miss Clauberton. Now, if you'll excuse me for a moment, I've been working on another case, and there's some papers on my desk that I...
You've no right to keep us here.
Please, Kathy.
Well, he hasn't, Michael, not without charges.
Then wait, and try to be calm.
Very interesting.
There's nothing incriminating in what I said, Inspector.
Oh, no, I wasn't referring to that. This memo. Good news.
Well, I'm not going to wait here and let you waste my time.
Mrs. Kingston, this building is full of policemen.
For pity's sake, Kathy, stop being so nervous.
If he has anything to say to us,
I have. One of you killed Fenimore Kingston this morning.
I wasn't home.
You were out driving. But who saw you, Mrs. Kingston?
What?
It takes at least two to make an alibi.
But surely you don't think that I...
Well,
You're out of your mind, Inspector. She married him only 3 months ago.
And then she changed her mind. She thought how nice it would be to marry you.
Inspector.
It's all right, Kathy. He's just fishing.
But that wasn't the reason Kingston was killed.
What?
Look out for him when he pitches curves.
You know the reason, Miss Cloverson.
Oh, now I'm it, huh?
Kingston found out that his famous diamond had become an imitation.
My ring?
This morning he took it out of the wall safe. The thief, the person who had made the substitution, was in the room with him. And Kingston was shot in the back and killed.
Don't look at me, Inspector. I wasn't there.
How about you, Mrs. Kingston?
I told you.
Yes. And you, Mr. Dole?
I didn't know anything about Fenimore's death until Catherine phoned me.
Then you admit that she phoned me.
Of course. It's no secret. I was Fenimore's cousin.
And you were making sure that Catherine stayed in the family.
Now, look here, Inspector.
Excuse me, please. Yes? All right. In a few minutes. I'll call you. Now, this memo becomes very important.
May we go now?
Don't rush me, Mrs. Kingston.
But if you're going to work on another case...
I'm not. An imitation of the Kingston diamond was made. And by a strange coincidence, shortly after Fenimore Kingston was murdered, the workroom of a diamond cutter was robbed.
What's that got to do with us?
Miss Cloverson, tell me what you know about Rudolf Leibniz.
What I know? Look, I may get around,
but
that...
Would you like to see him?
All right, if it'll make you happy.
I'll ask him to come in. What? He's in a room down the hall, Mr. Doze. I had him brought here from the hospital.
From the... hospital?
He wasn't dead.
You're lying.
Murphy, bring Leibniz in.
No.
Here.
No! No.
Never mind. Send in a stenographer. We're going to take a confession. Hello.
Inspector McKee, I'm sorry to be bothering you at your home, but when I return to headquarters this evening...
What is it, Cassidy?
Well, it's about that fellow Michael Dolge.
He killed his cousin, Fenimore Kingston.
Well, that's what the boys told me, but I'm...
He took the diamond and had the imitation put in.
You don't say.
Mm-hmm, about 3 weeks ago.
Wait, how did he get hold of it?
That was very simple. Catherine wore the ring at a house party. Dolge mentioned to Fenimore that the diamond needed cleaning and that he could take care of it for him.
Oh, so he took the stone down to Leibniz and had an imitation made.
That's right. It was so good that Fenimore didn't notice it right away. But this morning...
Ah, yes, this morning.
It's all in the confession, Cassidy.
Ah. Oh, then Kingston knew right away who had stolen the real diamond, didn't he now?
Yes, he did know.
Oh, Inspector, get along with you. Then why did he bother to phone that Amy Cloverson girl?
We'll never know, Cassidy. Maybe he was anxious to turn the clock back to better times.
And so closes tonight's Crime Club book, Dead Man Control, based on a story by Helen Riley. Stedman Coles did the radio adaptation. Roger Bauer produced and directed. Ted Osborne played Inspector McKee. Alice Frost was Catherine Kingston. Elspeth Eric was Amy. Sherling Oliver was Michael Dolge. And Barry Thompson played Catherine. Oh, I beg your pardon. Hello, I hope I haven't kept you waiting. Yes, this is the Crime Club. I'm the librarian. Yes, come over a week from tonight. We have a very unusual story of a will that had the power to kill. It's called Silent Witnesses by John Stephen Strange. In the meantime... Well, in the meantime, there is a new Crime Club book available this week and every week at bookstores everywhere. Yes, it's available now. Fine. And we'll look for you next week. Oh, yes. The United States Merchant Marine is offering this opportunity to young men between the ages of 16 and a half and 21. If you are an American citizen and a high school graduate, you are qualified to take the test for enrollment in the Merchant Marine Cadet Corps. Graduates of the Corps are qualified for a license as deck or engineer officer in the Merchant Marine or to a commission as ensign in the Naval Reserve or in the Maritime Service. Discharged veterans of the Armed Services and the Merchant Marine are eligible for the test up to their 24th birthday. They are also allowed 5 additional points on the test. The test is competitive and will next be held on April 4th.
program came from New York. This is the Mutual Broadcasting System.
Well, whatever the case is, it is now the case that we have a case of the breaks. Next up is an episode of Escape. Escape almost needs no introduction, but I'm going to do one anyway. It was a spinoff of the even more famous Suspense. It ran on CBS from 1947 to 1954, dealing a wide variety of stories. Science fiction, horror, murder, mystery. You know, it was just kind of fun for the whole family. Many of these episodes were taken from the classics, but not all. The writers and producers of Escape culled materials from stories that were not considered classics, but have gained that status since. Not that the radio show had a lot to do with that. The designation, the distinction, the rise to status of classic was brought about by the excellence of the material itself and the garnishment of time. Today's segment, Action, originally aired on July the 21st of 1949.
Suspense, which is usually heard at this hour on Thursday nights, is taking its customary summer holiday. Suspense returns to the air 6 weeks from tonight on Thursday, September 1st.
Hanging by your fingertips on the sheer face of an icy cliff, suspended 1,000 feet above instant death, with your strength running out and with no chance for escape.
We offer you Escape, designed to free you from the four walls of today for a half hour of high adventure. Tonight, we escape to the cold loneliness of a glacier high in the Swiss Alps, and to a man who learned much about death, as C.E. Montague tells it in his famous story, Action.
High in the Swiss Alps, well above 12,000 feet, a man clings with desperation to the frozen glass wall of the Chaliach Glacier. Hands and feet jammed into shallow steps, chopped in the iron-hard ice. A cold wind drives a spray of dusty sleet along the overhanging wall, and the sun has fallen away among the crags to the west. Darkness lies 1 hour ahead. The man has climbed with painful care 1,000 feet up the glacier's face from the broken moraine at the foot and has moved now onto the underside of a great bulge in the ice, a part of the wall which breaks out beyond the perpendicular. And the man is forced to hang from slots cut by his axe, such as a sloth hangs from a tree branch. 12 more feet lie between him and the brow of the overhang. 6 more steps to be chopped out with the axe. And 1,000 feet of void space waits beneath him. The man is unable to lift his heavy axe for even 1 more stroke. He is tired. And he is 52 years old. No experienced mountaineer would ever attempt the west face of the Chaliach Glacier. And yet, this man is an experienced mountaineer. And why? Why? What strange events have conspired to bring him along the path of his life and leave him hanging now, in peril, on the brink of eternity? Through what shadows has that path led him? And where are those who saw him pass? Can we ourselves move along it? Move back step by step against the river of time? Move backward along the life path of Christopher Bell?
My name is Jean Vajour. I'm a guide for all the mountain trails on the Weisshorn and the Schollhorn. I talked with Mr. Bell this morning as he was leaving the village. Though, of course, at the time, I did not know that was his name. The season is over, you understand. Winter will come in another week or two, and most all the visitors are gone. So, you see, I was very surprised to hear a stranger call out to me in English.
Hello there. Which of these paths takes me to the foot of the Schollhorn?
The one on the left. But you will find no chimney there, sir. One arrives very soon at the glacier and can go no farther.
Except, of course, to climb up it.
The glacier? But that is impossible. It has never been done.
Of course not. It's never been tried.
There is not anyone who would be so foolish, monsieur.
No, it isn't that. There are plenty of foolish people in the world. But even they hold on to their margin of safety.
Margin of safety?
Yes. The difference between the point where a man thinks he's reached his limit and the point where that limit really is.
I'm afraid I do not understand this.
All right. Take a mountaineer such as yourself. You look at a slope and you estimate the effort needed to climb it.
Yes.
Then you estimate your own endurance. And if there isn't a good size safety factor, just don't make the climb.
But it would be foolish not to do so.
I dare say. Oh, it's all tied up in the fear of death. You take that out of a man for one instant. There's no telling what he might be able to do, or what limit he might reach.
How should a man lose that fear?
He can't. He can't lose it. It has to be done for him, by things outside.
He turned and left me then, this Mr. Bell, and walked up the path towards the glacier. That was early this morning, and I did not see him again. His talk with me made no sense, and I could not understand what he meant to do or why he was going to do it. I remember thinking, what a strange man. But I really know nothing more about him. I believe he arrived in the village only last night and took a room in the Zinal Inn.
My name is Greta de Gaspar, and I am staying out the week here in Sinal to close up the inn for the winter. I have known Mr. Bell for the last 30 years, always before he came in the summer season for the climbing, and I was most surprised when he arrived last night. I opened one of the rooms, and I found something for him to eat, and then later we sat and talked in front of the fire in the big empty lounge.
Now, this is very good coffee, Madame Gaspar.
Thank you, Mr. Bell. Had you let me know you were coming, I would have had everything ready for you, just like all the other times.
Like all the other times. Now, this one's a little different, Madame Gaspar. You might call it a special visit.
Oh, it is all so different now from the old days. Then it was you and your Madame would come here, and it was Gaspar and I. And the summers seem to last forever.
I thought everything would last forever when she was alive. Now I'm really alone in the world.
As am I. And it is not good to be alone. It gives one no reason for living.
But there may be stronger reasons for not wanting to live.
Is there something troubling you, Mr. Bell?
No. No, not now. There may have been, but not now. Well, I shall be leaving quite early in the morning for a climb, so I think I'll go on to bed. Good night, Madame Gaspar.
Mr. Bell left the inn this morning before I awakened, and I have not seen him again. I have never known him to act so strange before. I have no idea what the reason is or what he may be planning to do, but I am sure something is troubling him. Perhaps it may be something connected with his business in London.
My name is Matthew Brough. I have been chief clerk in Mr. Bell's London office over the past 25 years. I've always found him to be a considerate and dependable employer. I've never noticed anything you might call unusual about him until one day, about 3 weeks ago. Mr. Bell entered the establishment a bit late, as I recall, and passed immediately into his own office without acknowledging my customary greeting. A little while afterward, he sent for me.
Well, Matthew, where do we go from here?
I can't say that I follow you, Mr. Bell.
I mean the company's on a steady footing, so if we use our heads at all, we don't stand much chance of losing anything.
Yes, our position is quite secure.
On the other hand, we can't expect to do any more growing. We're through expanding. Now on, it's merely a matter of operation.
A most enviable condition, sir.
Is it? There's nothing more to look forward to, nothing more to work for. So, where do we go from here?
Well, sir,
Matthew, I'm putting you in charge of the business, turning it over to you effective this week.
Mr. Bell, you can't possibly mean that.
Oh, yes, I've just decided.
But what are you going to do, sir?
I'm taking a trip. I'm going to Switzerland, maybe do a little mountain climbing.
Well, then at least it's only temporary, just for whatever time you're gone.
Yes, that's right. For whatever time I'm gone. Just for whatever time I'm gone.
Before the end of the week, he had arranged all the necessary papers and had left London. I haven't heard a word from him since, though I presume he's somewhere in Switzerland. Actually, however, I haven't the faintest idea where Mr. Bell may be right at this moment.
On the glacier, minutes pass, and the shadows grow longer from the jagged peaks to the west of the Shalyok, and reach out with dark fingers toward the man who clings to the icy wall. The man's thoughts have grown as unwieldy as the heavy ice axe gripped in his hand. He keeps trying to remember that he is Christopher Bell, a human being, and not a part of this free and empty space. For he knows if he stops remembering that, he may forget all else too. And then, let go.
There's been no reason for trying to locate Mr. Bell, since nothing of any importance has occurred during these 3 weeks. I'm sure he's quite all right. Only one thing still puzzles me a bit. The remarkable change in him on that morning 3 weeks ago. I'd never heard him talk like that before. And whatever the reason for it, I'm quite sure it was something that happened that morning before he came to the office.
My name is John Uxford. I've been a conductor on the Westminster route for some 14 years now. And during all that time, Mr. Bell has been a daily passenger of mine on the early morning inbound run. As I recall it, the first time anything you might say, well, out of the way ever happened between us, was one morning about 3 weeks ago. I saw Mr. Bell waiting at the usual place, so I signaled the driver to a stop.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Bell.
I'll be right there.
Yeah, now, let me come down and help you up, sir.
I'll make it. If you'll just take my arm, Mr. Huxford. My arm, please.
But I have taken it, Mr. Bell.
Oh, yes, of course. I'm sorry.
There we go. There we are, sir.
Oh, thank you. I had a bit of a shock this morning. I'm quite all right now.
Well, if it's all right now, then it's fine, I'd say. You take hold of that strap there now.
Oh, yes, of course. Oh, just a moment. I have the fare here somewhere. Oh, yes. Here you are.
Thank you, sir.
No, thank you.
Well, I don't quite understand what you mean, sir.
Mr. Huxford, have you ever had anyone take your arm and help you up a flight of steps?
No, and I might say I hope the day never comes when I... Well, I'm sorry, sir.
Not at all. Thank you, Mr. Huxford. Thank you very much.
I don't rightly know what was wrong with him, though it's certain that something was, as I haven't seen him for nearly 3 weeks now. I can't imagine what it might have been that happened to him that morning before he got on the bus.
My name is Jenkins, and I've been Mr. Bell's personal valet for the past 12 years and 7 months. The master is traveling somewhere on the continent just at present. Been gone something over 2 weeks now. Decided rather suddenly, I believe. In fact, I rather think something happened one morning about 3 weeks ago that caused him to make up his mind, though I really haven't the faintest idea what it might have been. I can remember noticing a very strange look on his face when he came down to breakfast that morning, but I thought nothing of it at the time.
Good morning, Jenkins.
Good morning, sir. I trust you had a pleasant night's rest.
Oh, yes, I did. Thanks, Jenkins.
You'll be having the usual orange juice, toast?
No. I want nothing except some coffee.
Very well, sir. I'll bring it right away.
I can't let him find out. I can't let anyone find out about it. Maybe it's a little better now. Maybe it's going away. Maybe I'm giving it too much importance. No, it's still there, that same lack of feeling, clear down the whole right side of my body. There. I can move my arms, my leg, all right. There's no feeling in them. They're numb. It's simply that at 52 years of age, I've had a light stroke.
Your coffee, sir.
Oh, thank you, Jim.
Would you care for something more, sir?
No, that's all.
If you'll pardon me, sir, you don't seem quite yourself this morning. I do hope you're not ill.
Oh, no, I'm quite all right, Jenkins.
I hope you won't mind my saying this, Mr. Bell, but you don't take very good care of yourself anymore.
Oh, now, Jenkins.
It's been years now since you had a checkup, sir. Not since the mistress passed away, in fact.
I'm quite all right, Jenkins. I'm quite all right.
Then I'm relieved to hear it, sir. I'll bring your paper now.
Good Lord. Is this what a man slaves his life away for, to end up helpless, dependent upon others, to be wheeled about, put out in the sun, taken in, like some great fat larva? That's disgusting. But I've got to face it. This stroke is the first warning. There'll be others, worse ones. And in a short time, I'll be helpless. Oh, there must be some way out. Not suicide, but some way. There's got to be some way.
The icy wall hardens into cold, vitreous steel as the dusk-born shadows chill its surface. The merciless ice is beginning to freeze the cramped joints of the man's fingers now. The heavy axe swings idly at his belt, tracing a fumbling pattern on the thin air of the void. How much longer now can he cling to those slots in the glacier's face? How much longer does he have to live? 30 seconds? A minute? What's the margin of safety now? And what does a man think of while his pulse beats slower? And he waits to die.
Strange how I'm able to go on hanging to this slope, clinging on to life, when I can't feel another ounce of strength left in me. I was right. Dying isn't so bad, really. Not when it's like this. It's rather pleasant, in fact. It looks so soft down there. The shadows and the snow. And the wind. Perhaps I could let go and float out in the wind like an eagle, and be blown along by it like drifting snow. The sun's gone now. It'll be full dark in a few minutes. Maybe I can hold on that long, till everything is dark, even the snow and the ice. Who knows? Perhaps I'll watch the sunrise tomorrow and set again. And even beyond... No. I can't last even one full minute longer. I'm through. I'm finished. I can't even last a half minute. Chips of ice sliding over the edge. Funny how a glacier sheds off that way. I suppose the difference in temperature between day and... Wait. ice axe. That was an axe. No other sound in the world like it. Fell from up above the overhang there. There must be somebody up there on the slopes, coming down from the top. There is. Wait. That's 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. That's a mountaineer's call for help. Someone's dropped his axe and he's in trouble up there. It's right above this bulge. If I can only... No. Throat's too dry. Well, 6 more steps to cut to reach the edge there. All right. 6 more steps. Now, 5 more steps. Just about does it. The last step.
Hey, cut the rope and let me go. There's no use in Bethlehem going.
Good Lord, it's a woman.
Hold on there. I'll be with you in a minute.
Hey, somebody's coming. There's someone down here.
Now, over the edge.
Take it easy there. Everything's going to be all right.
Oh, thank heaven. I don't know where you came from, but thank heaven you're here.
Here. Easy now. Let's get a step out for your feet here. I was just below the overhang there. Heard the fellow up above call out. He's got quite a voice on him.
It's my husband. Oh, please, hurry.
Easy now. Have a step out here in a second. You can put your feet on it. You get your breath. Then we'll tackle the slope. There now. That's it. I'll just scrape all this ice away. Easy there. Oh, that's better, isn't it?
Oh, yes.
You're all right now. You just lean there. And when you feel like it, we'll go on up. Oh, my name is Christopher Bell, by the way.
I'm Anna Gollan. Oh, thank you. I thought we were done. I was cutting steps down ahead in the slope and... I slipped and dropped my axe. The rope held me, but neither of us dared to move.
Well, you're all right now. As soon as you rest a minute, we'll cut some more steps back up the slope. You know, you shouldn't have started down this way. You'd never have been able to pass that bulge.
Yes, I can see that now. Of course, it's harder to tell when you're moving downslope.
Yes, I suppose it is.
You were coming up the slope, weren't you?
Yes, I came up from the foot.
Alone and without a rope, and you deliberately climb onto the underside of an overhanging wall.
Let's just say we're both foolhardy.
Is that what you call it?
Well, if you've got your breath back now, suppose we start up the slope.
Yes.
My name is Theodore Gollan, and I am the husband of the woman who slipped and fell on the wall of the glacier. I'm a physician, formerly of Harley Street, London. I've practiced in Paris for several years now. I met Mr. Bell when he and my wife reached the ice ledge where I stood waiting above them. I was not immediately aware of his trouble, but found out about it a short time later when we reached the rest hut at the top of the ridge. While my wife heated water for tea at the far side of the room, Bell and I fell into a much more personal conversation than strangers normally do. This sometimes happens when people have been very close to death.
Well, at any rate, Dr. Gollan, you can see how it is. The life of an invalid doesn't seem very appealing to me.
Tell me something, Mr. Bell.
Yes?
I gather you were pretty well done in when I called out there in a glacier. Couldn't lift a hand. Then how do you account for being able to chop 6 steps into that ice in a matter of some 5 minutes?
I don't know exactly. I was through. I couldn't have lasted 30 seconds more. But when I realized somebody was in danger, I forgot about it.
And this numbness, this lack of feeling in your right side, didn't bother you?
No, I didn't notice. It isn't quite so bad even now. There's your answer, Mr. Bell.
I don't believe I follow you.
Action. When you were in action, working because you had a reason, living because you had to, because somebody was depending on you, then you were all right. Everything was back in its place again.
Perhaps. But a man can't spend all his time climbing up a mountain.
Oh, I don't mean physical action, movement. Call it incentive, if you like. Maybe that's a better way to put it.
Incentive, eh?
It's the one top pressure that keeps life moving and growing.
Hmm.
And it's what you need.
Well, it's an interesting theory, Doctor.
But it's only a theory, hmm?
I'll have the tea ready in a moment. Anybody interested?
I am, my dear. Lucky we brought it.
If no one minds, I believe I'll have a turn outside while we're waiting.
Be careful out there in the dark. The ridge breaks off pretty sharply here.
Oh, I'll be careful. Dr. Gollan, if things were turned around, I wonder if it'd be any more than just a theory to you.
Mr. Bell, where are you?
I'm over here, Mrs. Gollan.
Beautiful, isn't it? With the stars so clear and bright.
Yes. Well, there won't be many more clear nights before the winter storms.
It would be a shame to give it up, you and I.
What do you mean?
I've got to say this quickly. We're not the kind to commit suicide, you and I.
What?
You deliberately climbed into a dead end out on that glacier. And I did the same thing. I went ahead and I picked the route down that slope.
Sure.
No, wait. In 30 seconds, I would have cut myself loose from that rope. Oh, we went to an awful lot of trouble so we wouldn't have to call it suicide.
You? But why?
I have a brain condition. There's no point in going into it, but it's incurable. Sooner or later, at any moment, I shall go blind.
Oh, no.
My husband doesn't know about it, and I don't want him to know. I'll make a bargain with you.
What sort of bargain?
I'm not brave, really. To go on living, I need something to cling to. I need to know all the time that there's someone else with courage, too. Mr. Bell, I'll go on living if you will.
I'd say you're amazingly brave.
If I were, I could do it alone, without having to make myself dependent on you and on your courage.
That sort of thing would work both ways. I wouldn't dare let you down.
Nor could I you. Do you want to make that bargain? Shall we go on living, Mr. Bell?
As I said before, I am Dr. Theodore Gollan. And I met Mr. Bell some 3 hours ago on the Shalioch Glacier. At the moment, he's outside the hut, a few yards away, talking to my wife. I can hear the sound of their voices, but I can't make out the words. However, I know what they're talking about and what his answer will be. My wife and I discussed that before she went to join him. You may have heard of my wife, incidentally, though it would likely have been under the stage name she uses in the Paris Theatre. You see, she's quite a talented actress.
Next week, we escape with a gripping story by Percival Gibbon entitled Second Class Passenger. Be with us next week at the same time when once again we offer you Escape. And now stay tuned for Casey, crime photographer, to hear the story of Durable Dennis. It'll be along in just a few moments on most of these same CBS stations. This is Tip Corning speaking. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
We got a break. But we'll be back real soon with some science fiction. I hope you like science fiction. I sure do. I do like to occasionally bring things that are not American. And today, we have one of those. SF-68 was a South African broadcast featuring pretty high-caliber adaptation of mostly previously published short stories from established science fiction writers. People like Bradbury, Harlan Ellison, Murray Leinster. The shows were well-made and interesting. They were produced and directed by the Dean of South African Radio, Michael McCabe. Unfortunately, it was, despite its excellence, a short-lived series that had its run, appropriately enough, in the year of 1968, after which it was dropped in favor of a murder horror series called Beyond Midnight, which was also produced by McCabe and was far more successful and deserved to be successful. It was a good show, too. Today's story from SF-68 is an adaptation of a short story by Walter M. Miller called The Will. Miller was a well-established and really quite famous science fiction writer, best known for his 1960... Gotta slow down here a little bit to make sure I say it somewhere near right. Post-apocalyptic novel, A Canticle for Leibowitz. If you haven't read this story, well, it would be hard to overestimate its influence on science fiction of the era. I don't know if it's in print or not, but if it is, get it. Read it. You will not be sorry.
SF-68.
Biotex, the new soak and pre-wash powder, brings you SF-68. Stories which plunge vividly into other worlds, other dimensions, other times. SF-68.
The gleaming new wax finish on your furniture with Pledge. You simply spray it on and wipe. Pledge waxes and polishes instantly as you dust. There's no rubbing required. Give new life to tired-looking furniture with Pledge. Look for the push-button aerosol can. Pledge, now only 59 cents.
I feel great. You are my sunshine, my...
A moment ago, you had a splitting headache.
That was before I took a Grandpa Headache Powder.
Grandpa Headache Powders kill pain, soothe strained nerves, and lift depression. Grandpa Headache Powders work quickly because their famous triple action formula dissolves almost immediately. Get the quickest relief of any pain, all pain. Get Grandpa Headache Powders.
Ah, Grandpa.
SF-68 presents The Will, adapted for radio and produced by Michael McCabe. The Will. Who played in the sun and ran over the meadow to chase with his dog among the trees beyond the hedge and knew the fierce passions of childhood. A child whose logic cut corners and sought the shortest distances and found them. A child
child who made shining life in my house. Thanks. We can't cure him, Rod. We can only treat symptoms and hope with a little more research that... I'm sorry.
He'll die?
Unless they get an answer, the research labs.
How long?
Months. I thought you'd want it. Well, straight like this.
Why? Because you know I'm only his foster father. As if that mattered.
Right.
Or because you think I'm hard enough to take it. Sorry. Forget I said that. Thanks for letting me know.
I'll keep in touch.
Thanks. Somehow I've got to tell Chloe. Well.
Take care.
Captain Kronos, custodian of time. Travel through the centuries with a master of the clock.
Hi, Kenny boy. How's this? Oh, sorry. Didn't know you listened to the opening spiel. It's always the same.
Captain Kronos, defender of the temporal passes, champion of the temporal guard. Fly with Captain Kronos in his time ship century as he battles against those evil forces.
Captain Kronos. Everything's easy for Captain Ruddy Kronos. All simple for Captain Kronos. I took down an encyclopedia. Volume Lack No. An envelope fell out. I picked it up. Kenny's writing was on the front.
Lebanon. Do not open until 1978. Value, 1967, 38 cents.
I knew what was inside without holding it up to the light. Kenny's idea of buried treasure. When he had more than one stamp of an issue in his collection, he'd always put the duplicate away somewhere and let it age so that its value would increase. I found the article I'd been looking for in the heavy old volume, but it didn't help. I wasn't a doctor. Half the Latin medical terms were beyond me. Anyway, just by knowing the precise nature of Kenny's disease, how was that going to help? Kenny knew he was sick. He knew several specialists that studied his case. You can't keep much from a 14-year-old. Within 2 weeks, he knew he had less than a year to live. He pieced it all together from conversational fragments and chance remarks. He cross-questioned the elder brother of one of his friends, a boy called Mark David, who happened to be a medical student. A child is blunt in his questioning, tactless in matters that concern himself.
Rod, when you saw Dr. Jules, what did he say? I mean, what exactly did he say? I mean, if they don't find a cure, when will I die? Will it hurt?
Kenny, there are a lot of people trying very hard to help you.
Well, what will you do with my things if I die? Hey, will I see my real father afterwards?
Kenny!
I like it on moonshine nights, Rod. I think I like the nights best of all. Better than the daytime.
Well, so do I. Beautiful.
Rod, I don't want to die.
There's a difference between tragedy and blind, brutal calamity. Tragedy's got meaning. There's a certain dignity in it. But there's no meaning, no dignity, no fulfillment in the death of a child. Kenny, I want you to try and have faith. The research people are working hard. I want you to try and have faith that they'll find a cure.
Mark says it went before years and years. And he's a medical student. He knows everything about
Mark
it.
Mark doesn't know. He's just a kid himself. Nobody knows when they might find a cure. It might be next week.
I wish I had a time ship like Captain Kronos.
Why?
Because then I could go to some year when they knew how to cure me. I bet they'll be able to do that someday, too. I bet the government's working on it now. Gosh, think of it, Rod. You could do anything if you had a time ship. If you wanted to know something that nobody knew, you could just go to some year when it's been discovered.
But you see, Kenny, if that were possible, everyone would try it, and nobody would work on new discoveries. And nothing would be found out that was new. Besides, nobody's proved yet that the time travel is possible.
Scientists can do anything.
Only things that are possible, Kenny. And only with money and time and a reason.
Would it cost a lot to research for a time ship, Dad?
Quite a lot, I think. If they could find somebody to do it.
As much as an atom bomb?
Maybe.
I bet my stamp collection will be worth a lot of money one day. And my autograph book. And there's the banks.
Yes, one day your collection might be worth something. In a century, perhaps. But the banks won't wait that long, boy.
Dad, don't you see? What difference does time make if you're working on a time machine?
The doctors are doing all they can. Try. try and have faith. Jenny. Kenny built a time ship in the fork of a big tree at the bottom of the garden. He built two seats in it and made a fishbowl canopy over a hole in the top. He took a picture of it with his box camera and sent a copy with a fan letter to Captain Cronus. And then one day he fainted and fell out of the tree.
Investigations concerning the psychogenic factors show only...
All 75, Ront. Guru Taj Vashivi guarantees...
Sickness is only an illusion. Have faith.
We cannot promise anything in the near future, but the Institute is rapidly finding new directions.
Allow us to extend sympathy.
The powers of hydromagnetic massage therapy have been established by the...
And so it went on. We talked to crackpots, confident men, respectable scientists, fanatics, lunatics, and a few honest fools. And then, Kenny started working on it himself.
The labs aren't going to find it in time. I've been reading what they say, Dad. It's no good.
It was good that he'd relearned to cry. But the next day, his spirits soared mysteriously to a new high.
Hey, Kenny! What have you been up to, Kenny? Come on now, you don't go wandering around muttering to yourself unless you're cooking something up. What is it, another time ship? I heard you hammering in the garage before dinner.
I was just knocking the lid of an old bread box.
I couldn't get any answer but evasions. Innocent glances, mysterious smacks. I let him keep his secret, thinking that his enthusiasm for whatever he was doing would soon wear off. And then the photographers came.
You see, sir, we just want one or two pictures, that's all. A few pictures of Kenny's treehouse.
Why? How do you know he had one?
Well, you see, they're doing a feature article on the effects of science fantasy on kids. You know, TV shows. And your son's fan letter to Captain Cronos was forwarded to the sponsors and the show's producer. Well, they want some shots of Kenny in
his machine. I'm sorry, it's impossible.
Well, we'd be glad to pay something.
The child's sick, if you must know. He can't get up in the tree anymore.
Oh, I'm so... Well, maybe when he's feeling better.
He won't be feeling better. Now, please leave.
The photographers left. And they were only doing their jobs, I suppose. They saw Chloe in the garden. And I think she explained to them just why Kenny couldn't get up into his tree timeship. Because a week later, we had another visitor. We were drinking our coffee after dinner. And Chloe herself answered the doorbell.
Chloe? What is it, darling? Chloe! What's happening? What?
It stood there in the doorway with a stunned expression on its face. It wore a silver uniform with jackboots, black and red cape, and a weird helmet with antennae protruding from it. It had a lantern jaw and a big, meaty, benign countenance. It was Captain Cronus.
I'm awfully sorry. We just drove over from the studio without...
Captain Cronus!
Kenny, go back to bed.
Mr. Westler, the producers of the show and myself, we make a habit of visiting sick children. We also visit hospitals.
Where's the photographer?
Look
That's
here.
That's a tape recorder you've got there.
Are you really Captain Cronus?
Mr. Westler, on Wednesday evenings, we always have a children's panel, you know, junior guardsmen. And now we know Kenny can't come to the studio. Well, we wanted to get your permission to let us wire the place and interview Kenny by telephone.
Get out!
No, Dad! Well, what does the monster...
Kenny, go to bed! You, scram!
Well, I only wanted to get your permission to let us...
You didn't have to do that,
Dad. Go on to bed, son. Come on.
Why can't he go on the show? Why?
Do you want that child to get the full treatment? Do you want him to end up a sob story child?
Certainly not. But it was cruel, Rod. He never had a happier moment in...
All right, I'm a pig. Sorry.
Please let them do it.
Kenny's sick. I'm not having him do publicity stunts for the sake of a nutritious and delicious fluffy crunkles.
If it was in good taste... If they abided by our conditions...
If they abide by our conditions. And if the offer's still open. The offer was still open. Kenny was to be on the show. They rehearsed him a bit at home and let him play with a tape recorder until he got used to his voice. Kenny did his show by telephone from the house. It was a great success. During the time Kenny talked with Kronos and his guardsmen, he lived. He really lived. He asked the other children if they had any stamps to exchange, and autographs, too. And a few days later, when the post came, we were swamped. Bushels of stamps, books of autographs. Kenny was delighted. He spent hours sorting through his new mammoth collection. He became more mysterious than ever. He began going on walks by himself out in the woods. Whatever he was doing was a shadowy, secret business. It involved spades and garden implements and packages. I found him in the woods one evening. He wasn't too strong at the time, and Chloe was anxious. He'd had one or two fainting spells.
What are you doing, Kenny? You better come back to the house. Your mother's worried about you.
You'll know, Dad, in 4 or 5 months. Don't ask me now. You'd only laugh.
You mustn't come out here on your own, son.
I've got to come here, Dad. I've got to. How else will I be able to make contact with them?
Contact? With whom?
You'll know, Dad. Soon. Just a few months. Please don't ask me now. I don't want you to laugh at me.
I wouldn't laugh at you, Kenny. Too much to expect of a child, but has something changed him? Has something happened to him? Something will let him die calmly because he knows that someday there'll be a cure.
Could be. It might fit in with this secrecy business.
Oh, how's that?
People who know they're dying often behave that way. Little secret activities that don't become apparent until after they've gone. Immortality cravings.
And Kenny?
I don't know, Rudd. I've seen a lot of death. Some people do things so they'll be remembered. Through art or science. You know, I believe there's more than plain selfishness to people's immortality cravings. But Kenny's just a child. I don't know.
He fainted down by the creek yesterday.
I'm sorry. It must be hard for Chloe, knowing that unless there's a medical...
He's burying things. It seems happy, almost. You should see him, Jules. Happy as he'd ever been. Happy as he was when he did that show with Captain Cronus and the time show.
The weeks passed. We couldn't allow Kenny out on his own anymore. Chloe was resigned. I've always regarded women as the stronger sex. I loved her very dearly during those days. One early morning, 2 o'clock it was, something woke me up. A sound, something. I went to Kenny's room. He wasn't there.
Kenny! Stop! Wait! Stop!
Kenny! Kenny!
He was in the garden, crumpled over a spade. He'd been digging.
Oh, Kenny!
Glad you found it. Here you found it. Got me to the right time. Where are we?
Kenny!
Okay, help, darling, just take it. Okay, son, it's all right. It's all right, boy.
I'm so glad you found me. But I knew you would.
Okay, son, how do you feel now? You mustn't go out at night, Kenny. You've got to promise you won't.
Oh, okay. Chocolate, isn't it? Drink it up, darling.
Oh, what's this, eh? Kenny? You've been drawing treasure maps, eh? X. Down by the fork of the creek. X. Looking for treasure, are you? Keep it for the daytime, won't you? And then let me or your mother come with you. What's the matter, son? Expecting to wake up somewhere else?
Must have been a dream. I thought they came early.
Who came early?
You'll find out all about it in 4 months.
He wouldn't last long, the doctor said. Jules ordered him to stay inside completely from then on. It was all beginning to tell on Chloe. I wondered if she'd break. There was talk of moving him to a hospital, but he said he wouldn't go. One night, after lying quietly all day, sleeping most of the time, as if saving up energy for a last spurt, Kenny slipped away again. He must only have been gone a few minutes before I woke up, because I'm sure I heard the screen door. Remembering the map he had drawn, and the X by the fork in the creek, that's the way I went. He had taken my flashlight.
Kenny! Come back, son! Kenny, where are you?
Don't try to follow me, Dad!
Kenny!
Don't follow me, Dad! I'm going where they can cure me!
I went along the edge of the pasture next to the woods until I came to a dry wash that I knew led back to the creek. After a few minutes, I stumbled onto the bank of a narrow stream.
Kenny!
After 20 minutes, I saw the gleam of a flashlight. He was digging. Always he was digging.
Kenny! Kenny, don't run away from me again. I'm not angry. Kenny!
Stay where you are, Dad. And let me finish. Then I'll go with you. If you come any closer, I'll run. Stay there now.
Then will you come back to the house?
I won't run if you stay there.
Okay, but don't take too long. Chloe's frantic.
He put the light on a rock and turned it on me. It blinded me. He stopped digging and hauled something from the hole. He pried something open and then it seemed as if he was writing something on it. Then, whatever it was, he placed it back in the hole. And he began covering it again. In a couple of minutes, he was finished. And then the light went out.
Kenny!
I'm sorry, Dad. I didn't want to lie. I have to.
Kenny! Please, son. Don't run away again. Kenny, I can't see you. Put the light on.
Then I found a clock. Chloe's kitchen clock. It was lying in the grass. It was luminous. I noticed that, as always, it was a few minutes slow. What had Kenny wanted with a clock? I picked it up and turned to follow Kenny. I couldn't see him. There was no moon that night. And then it happened.
It was in the meadow. It was black. It was bigger than a double garage and round. I stared at it. I realized it was not an object, but an opening.
Come on along here, little boy.
Then I saw Kenny. He was crawling toward the opening.
Kenny, don't!
He got to his feet and stumbled toward the distorted space. It seemed to squeeze him into a grotesque house of mirrors shape. Then it spun him inward. Gone! Was gone. We never saw him again. Chloe confirmed what I'd seen in the meadow, but without a body. Kenny remains listed as missing. Missing from this century. I went back to the fork in the creek and dug up the bread box he had buried. It contained his stamp collection and a packet of famous autographs. There was a letter from Kenny, too, addressed to the future, and it was his will.
Whoever finds this, please sell these things and use the money to pay for a time machine so you can come and get me. Because I'm going to die if you don't.
I don't think the bank will wait 100 years.
But, Dad, don't you see? What difference does time make if you're working on a time machine?
Kenny had made an act of faith. Faith in tomorrow. He had buried the note and then had gone back to dig it up. And changed the rendezvous time from 4 months away to the night of his disappearance. He knew he wouldn't have lived that long. I put everything back in the box and sealed the box with solder and set it in concrete at the foot of a hole 2 yards deep with this manuscript. To a reader, yet unborn, who finds this account in a dusty and ancient magazine stack or recorded on old tape or a gramophone record, dig for the box. Follow the instructions set out below. But not unless the world is ready to buy a time machine and can come for Kenny. If this is so, he can be brought back to a time close to the time he was born in. Kenny financed the machine, if it exists by now. Come if you can cure him. He had faith in you. There's a feeling of death in my house. But after a century of tomorrows, he invested in them. And he called out to them, pleading with the voice of a child. And tomorrow answered.
Come, little boy, be me.
Thank you.
Now, before you go, I want to say, ladies, a little bit more about Biotex, the amazing new washing product.
When you use new Biotex.
You have just been listening to The Will by Walter M. Miller, brought to you by Biotex, the new soak and pre-wash powder. The Will was adapted for broadcasting and produced by Michael McCabe. Listen again next Friday night at 9:30 to SF 68.
Incredible, but true. The sight of old battlefields invariably evokes in our mind's eye a vision of the men who fought on them in a former day. But all this, we insist, is merely an association of ideas. And we continue to insist, even though there is on record an authentic story which goes far to prove us wrong.
It was on Saturday night, November 5th, 1932, that Tom Horner drove with his friend Arthur Wright from Filey to Harrogate.
I'll wager you aren't even aware that we're right in the middle of Marston Moor, are you, Tom?
Marston Moor? Didn't some battle or other take place there?
One of the greatest battles of all time. It's where Cromwell's men defeated King Charles' army in 1644. Right where we're driving, along this road. Though, of course, the road itself probably was... Uh-oh. Watch out, old boy. Another car coming toward us. It's a bus of some kind.
Just as the two vehicles were about to pass each other, Wright gasped...
Tom, look out! Those men!
Suddenly, two men had appeared, walking down the center of the highway, just a few feet in front of the car.
I say, Tom, they've got long hair.
They're wearing hats with cockades in them. And cloaks. And boots.
Well, they must be going to a masquerade party of some sort.
Well, wherever they're going, I wish they'd get a move on. There isn't room to pass them.
The two strange figures paid no attention to Tom Horner's signal. Instead, they trudged slowly down the middle of the road. And Tom had no choice but to creep on behind them. For on one side of him, the bus was passing now. And on the other, a high hedge marked the edge of the road. When the bus had passed, Tom switched on his bright lights.
Now we can see what those chaps really look like. I couldn't tell whether... Hello? What happened to them?
The two figures had disappeared. Baffled and incredulous, Horner stopped the car. And he and Wright climbed out and peered up and down the road. They walked back several yards in the darkness.
But they couldn't have got off the road. No one could jump those hedges or even get through them. At least not in 2 seconds.
Well, perhaps, Tom, perhaps there weren't any men. We must have imagined it.
How could we both of us imagine the same thing?
Well, I don't know. It's possible, I suppose. We were both talking about Marston Moor, about this being a battlefield. By George, those men were dressed like soldiers. Like soldiers from Cromwell's army.
Come to think of it, they were, weren't they? Still, I don't see...
I know, it doesn't make sense. But it's the only logical answer. There simply weren't
any... Hello there!
The voice came to them through the mist and darkness. Horner turned quickly and saw a man approaching.
Hello! Who are you?
I'm the bus driver. Just passed you back there in the road. You didn't happen to see a couple of queer-looking blokes with long hair? They were walking down the middle of the road half a minute ago.
And so Tom Horner and Arthur Wright knew that they had not imagined the strange figures. For now a third witness had testified to their reality. Here on Marston Moor, almost 300 years after the most famous battle of the Great Rebellion, two men, dressed like soldiers in the Parliamentary Army, had appeared for a moment and then vanished. If we deny that they were stragglers out of the remote past, out of the days of Cromwell and King Charles, then how shall we explain this remarkable vision? A vision incredible but true.
And another break. Hopefully this will be the last one. Next up is an episode of The Black Museum, which ran in 1951 and 1952. I believe this particular story was in 1951. The Black Museum was produced by Henry Allen Towers. Harry Allen Towers, for the BBC, and would later air on the United States on the Mutual Network between January 1st of 1952 and December of that year. The show dramatized true cases from the files of Scotland Yard's Black Museum, wherein the narrator, the inimitable Orson Welles, tells us the story of one or another grisly murders. Nearly always, accomplished by the means of some ordinary object, preserved and on exhibit in Scotland Yard's Black Museum. In this case, a brass button. An innocuous, ordinary brass button. A brass button that was found near the body of this woman who was very dead.
This is Orson Welles, speaking from London. Here in the grim stone structure on the Thames, which houses Scotland Yard, is a warehouse of souvenirs, where everyday objects, a candlestick, a china doll, a broom, all are touched by murder. Now take this button, this brass button, the symbol of a barracks parade ground, but this was not found on any parade ground.
This is interesting, sir. A brass button.
Very interesting, Sergeant. It's from an army uniform.
Today, that button can be seen in the Black Museum.
From the annals of the Criminal Investigation Department of the London Police, we bring you the dramatic stories of the crimes recorded by the objects in Scotland Yard's Gallery of Death, the Black Museum. In just a moment, you will hear The Black Museum, starring Orson Welles. The Black Museum, starring Orson Welles.
Well, here we are, the Black Museum, Scotland Yard's Museum of Murder. Shelf upon shelf of curious and repellent objects. The urge to kill, illustrated in many, many ways. Here lies death. Here in the echoing stillnesses of the long room, one stands and looks at violence, expressed by the exhibits that line the shelves, the tables, and the walls. Repellent they may be, but by reason of their association only, for most of these tokens of murder are very ordinary objects. It's a medicine bottle. The drug it contained was beneficial in small doses. But since a woman was forced to drink the whole contents and died shortly after, the jury called it murder. Here's a kitchen knife. No household is without one, but this knife was not used solely for kitchen tasks. It was found embedded in a man's heart. Now, here we are, the brass button. It is. It's an innocuous, ordinary brass button. This was found near the dead body of a woman. But come back with me to the beginning of this story, to a day some years ago on the common outside the Kentish village of Wayfield. A girl was sitting beneath a tree, busily sketching. She was too engrossed to hear the approach of a young soldier until he spoke.
Hello?
Oh. Hello?
Sorry. Did I frighten you?
A little. I didn't hear you coming.
Oh, I made enough row. You were so busy with whatever you're doing. What are you doing?
Sketching.
Can I see?
You'll probably laugh.
No, I won't. Show me. That's very good.
Do you really think so?
Well, it's fine. You must be the one they call the Swamp Girl.
That's what they call me in the village. Huh. Poor, routine, dull people.
You don't like routine ways of living, do you? From what I've heard, you're something of a rebel.
Am I?
Hmm.
You seem to know a lot about me.
Oh, I've heard things.
What kind of things?
About how you live in an old shanty at the edge of the swamp, and how you roam the common and sketch and paint.
You're well informed.
People talk about you sometimes. I was interested.
Then so you came down to see for yourself. Well, what's the matter? Couldn't you find a girl in town?
Don't say that. I wanted to meet you. To talk to you.
And now that you have, will you please go away and let me work?
Oh, you can work any time. I'll go away soon, if you're nice to me.
Go now. I've no intention of being nice to you, whatever you may think.
Come on.
Get away. When you found out so much about me, you might have also found out that I'm not interested in men. Least of all, soldiers.
That's not very kind. Come here.
You... Go away.
Come here.
No. No. Please don't hurt me. No, please. No.
A woman screamed and cried for help on the Wayfield Common. But there was no one within a mile to hear her screams. 2 days later in the post office at Wayfield, a letter was returned by the postmistress.
Mrs. Riley.
Yes, Jimmy?
That registered letter you sent me out with, there was nobody about to sign for it.
You wasn't the swamp girl at home.
No, ma'am. I called out Miss Morgan, but there wasn't any answer.
All right. You can deliver it tomorrow.
Yes, ma'am.
Her name was Jeanette Morgan. But people of the town called her the swamp girl because of her vagrant, strange way of living. The next day, Jimmy, the postal messenger, rode out on his bike to deliver the registered letter. But once again, the swamp girl was not at home. Then, on the way back, taking a shortcut, Jimmy found her.
Miss Morgan!
Jimmy saw only her legs at first protruding from a bush, which had been meant to hide her. At first, he thought she was asleep. He didn't think so for long.
She's dead! I've got to get the police.
Murder transforms a little village like Wayfield. All work ceases. The people gather in small groups in the streets to talk about it.
Yes. Have you heard the news? There's been a murder.
Eh? A murder?
Yes. Out on the common.
Who?
The swamp girl. They found her body.
I was rather afraid that poor girl would come to grief sooner or later.
Well, Vicar, you know how it is these days. No parental authority.
Ah, more's the pity. Be that as it may, the man who did it must be found.
You know, Bert, if young Jimmy Miles hadn't come upon that body like he did, it might have lain there hidden for months, even years. I wonder how it happened.
Well, now, the way I sees it is this.
Now in the bar of the local, they sipped their beer and discussed the sensation. Jimmy became something of a hero. He'd found the body and even now is being questioned by the London detectives from Scotland Yard.
This is Jimmy Miles, sir.
Hello, Jimmy. You found the body, I understand.
Yes, Inspector Gallico. Was she really murdered, sir?
Well, that's what we must find out. And you can help us.
Oh, really? How?
I believe you rode out to her shanty at the edge of the swamp to deliver a registered letter to Miss Morgan.
Yes, that's right, sir. She used to get a registered letter every month. I always took them out.
And she had to sign for them, of course.
Oh, yes.
Then you got to know her, I suppose.
Well, don't tell the postmistress, but sometimes I did stay and talk for a while.
Uh-huh. And what was she like?
Oh, she was nice, really friendly. People said she was a bit peculiar, but I never thought so. And she could draw, sir.
Now, think carefully, Jimmy. Did you ever see her with anyone, man or woman?
Oh, never, Inspector. She had no friends around here. She once told me, sir.
No friends, I see. Now, about this registered letter, was that the first time you had taken it out?
Oh, no, sir. I went out the previous day, on Monday, but she wasn't there.
Did you call out?
Yes, and I went round the common to the places where she used to go and sketch. I knew most of them.
And she wasn't anywhere about?
No, nowhere at all.
What time of the day was this?
Well, I just left the post office just on 10. It's about half an hour's ride.
Oh, you were out there by 10:30.
Hmm.
All right, Jimmy. Thank you very much.
Was that all, Inspector Gallico?
Well, that's all for the moment. You've been very helpful.
A lucky witness, young Jimmy Miles. A break for Inspector Gallico early in the case. For with the evidence of the police surgeon, certain facts could be established.
What's your verdict on the post-mortem, Doctor?
Well, the cause of death didn't give us any trouble, Inspector. She was strangled.
What about the time of death?
That's not so easy. I'd say she died 48 hours ago, at least.
Wait a minute. That means before noon on Monday. It ties in, Doctor.
Good. But at what time before noon, I would not care to predict. The contents of the stomach indicate she'd had breakfast.
Then sometime between breakfast and noon, she met her death. And she was nowhere about 10:30 when the postal boy brought her letter. What about that letter, Sergeant?
I have it here, sir.
Who is it from?
It's from Mrs. Morgan of Tunbridge Wells, her mother.
Money, I suppose.
£10, sir. And a plea to come home and live a normal life.
Poor Mrs. Morgan. Her daughter couldn't even die a normal death.
The pattern of the crime begins to make itself clear. The victim's identity is known. The approximate time and the cause of death is known. Now the hunt will begin for the killer.
Here is a police message. The body of a woman named Jeanette Morgan has been discovered on Wayfield Common. Evidence suggests that she met her death by strangulation sometime before noon on October the 19th. Any person who was in the vicinity of Wayfield Common on that day or can give any information, should communicate with the nearest police station in order to assist in the search for the murderer.
And in this, the police will be aided by a brass button. That same brass button, but today can be found in the Black Museum. To a small cottage in Tunbridge Wells now go the detectives from Scotland Yard. To a house with the blinds drawn where a thin, bitter woman answers their questions in a strangely lifeless voice.
Yes, I knew. I knew it was Jeanette when I saw the newspapers.
Why didn't you get in touch with us, Mum?
Oh, I knew you'd get in touch with me if you wanted me. Besides, what business is it of mine?
But she was your daughter.
Was she? Jeanette's younger sister lives here with me. Works at a shop nearby. She's my daughter.
Yes, I see what you mean.
I warned her. I told her it had come to no good end. Maybe in that strange and unnatural kind of way.
Mrs. Morgan, we won't trouble you any longer, but could you tell us, did your daughter have any close men friends?
Men friends?
Yes.
Jeanette? I wish she had. But a boyfriend would have been too ordinary for her. She had to be different. She had to be
The swamp girl.
I'm sorry.
Why did it have to happen to her? To me? Why? Why? Why?
Good evening.
Good evening, Vicar. I'm from the police.
The police? I don't recognize you.
No, sir. You see, I'm not from the local police. I'm from London. And I'm down here in connection with the murder.
Oh, yes. Terrible, yes. But how can I help you?
Well, you can help a good deal, sir. You see, the local police are pretty short-handed, and Inspector Gallagher has decided that our next move should be to make a very thorough search of the common, particularly round about where the body was found.
Oh, I see. And I suppose you want some help from my parishioners?
Yes, sir. That's roughly the idea.
Very well, then. We'll help you in every way we can. You can depend upon us.
All right, Sergeant. Let's get on with the search.
Very good, sir.
You yes. take Smart and work in from the road.
Right,
I'll
sir.
Take Rogers and work in from the field side. I'll meet you by the ditch.
Yes, that'll be all right, sir. Here's a sketch, sir. It's a pencil drawing of that view across there, I'd say, sir.
Yes, it is. Unfinished, too. She might have been working on it. What else have you got there?
This is interesting, sir. It's a brass button.
Very interesting, Sergeant. It's from an army uniform.
Uh-huh.
Where's the nearest camp to Wayfield?
I believe it's one across the river, sir, about 2 miles away.
Inspector Gallico left his sergeant in charge of searching the common and went to the army camp to enlist the help and cooperation of the commanding officer.
Gentlemen, to see you, sir, from Scotland Yard.
Oh, ask him to come in, will you, Captain?
Yes, sir. Will you come through, please?
Thank you.
Major Curtis, I'm Inspector Gallico from Scotland Yard.
How do you do, Inspector? Sit down, won't you? Well, now, how can I help you, Inspector?
I'm here to investigate the murder of Jeanette Morgan.
Oh, the swamp girl mystery.
Yes.
Yes, tragic business.
Major, not far from where the body was left, we found this...
an army button.
That's why I'm here.
I see. Well, I'd be glad to assist in any way I can, but permit me to hope that it wasn't any one of my men.
How many men are there in camp here, Major?
Well, at the present time, our unit's strength is 120. We're an engineer section, as you may know.
120 men, huh?
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if any of them has a button missing from his tunic.
Well, if you wish, I'll order an immediate inspection.
Not yet, sir. You can assist me in another way first.
Oh? How, Inspector?
Well, I want a list of all those absent from camp on Monday morning.
Oh, that should be easy. There's no leave on any week morning. If anyone was away from camp, it must have been for a special reason.
Anyone at all, between the hours of 7 a.m. and 1 o'clock.
Well, the adjutant can help us, though. I'll get him to make out a list of all those away from camp on Monday morning immediately.
The commanding officer was away a short time, and on his return he brought with him a piece of paper containing a list of names. He gave it to the London detective.
Yes, there you are, Inspector. 5 men were away from camp during the time you asked about.
Hmm. Sergeant Willis. Hey, company.
Yes, he's our caterer at the present time. We're understaffed, of course. Sergeant Willis and Private Fields were in town with a provision truck.
They were together?
Yes, we could always check that with one or the other.
I don't think I'm very interested in those two.
Oh?
What about Private Liston, B Company?
Oh, he's the unit driver. I sent him into town shortly before noon. On a private errand.
Shortly before noon, hmm? Well, that leaves 2. Corporal Paul Ferris?
Oh, he's our mailman. He leaves every morning at 8 o'clock and drives the mail truck in to pick up the unit mail bag.
From the Wayfield post office, I suppose?
Yes.
What time does he generally return?
Oh, sometimes by 9. Though on occasions he has to wait for registered mail, you know. I've even known him to be held up as late as 11 or even 11:30.
Would anyone know what time he returned on Monday?
I'll find that out for you.
Now, this last man, Private Williams, A Company.
Yes, if you ask me, he might be your man, Inspector.
Oh, why, sir?
Because he was absent without leave.
From 900 hours on Monday morning until 1400 hours.
From 9 till 2?
Yes.
That's interesting. I'd better see him. And the postal chappy.
I'll have them paraded. Corporal Ferris? Private Williams? This is Inspector Gallico from Scotland Yard. He has some questions to ask you both.
Thank you, sir. Corporal Ferris, we'll take you first.
Yes, Inspector.
What time did you leave camp last Monday morning on your mail run?
At 800 hours, sir.
And what time did you return?
Well, if I remember correctly, the mail was brought round rather late that morning, Corporal. Yes, sir. I was just about to explain to the inspector. I had to wait for several registered letters.
What time did you actually return?
Shortly before 1100 hours, sir.
Thank you, Corporal. Now, Private Williams. You were absent without leave throughout Monday morning.
Yes, sir.
Are you able to give a satisfactory account of your whereabouts?
I'd prefer not to, sir.
Private Williams has consistently refused any explanation of his conduct, Inspector.
Oh, that's rather unwise, Williams. If you have an alibi, you'll need it. This is an investigation into murder.
Murder? I didn't do no murder. I was with me girl in Wakefield.
Ah, what's her name?
Hey, Susie Walker, 9 High Street. You asked her if I wasn't there. Oh, I didn't want to get her into any trouble, you understand, that's all. But murder? Oh, I don't know nothing about the girl who was killed. Honest, I don't.
Well, we'll check your statement, Williams. I've finished with them now, sir.
Corporal Ferris, Private Williams, dismiss.
Inspector Gallico drove into Wakefield to number 9 High Street.
Oh, no. Susie wasn't out with him that day. I remember it distinctly. She went over to see her girlfriend at Kenbury. Well, you can ask her yourself.
Susie Walker was a small, frightened girl, the counterpart of Private Williams.
Oh, Inspector, I hope he hasn't done anything wrong up at the camp in not telling them where he was. Oh, that'd be terrible. He wouldn't tell a lie, I know that. I'm sure of it. You see, we'd had a quarrel, and he wanted to see me. I didn't dare let Mother know, so I made up a story about it.
She confirmed his alibi, and Gallagher went next to the post office to interview Mrs. Riley.
Just one inquiry I'd like to make, Mrs. Riley.
Oh, anything at all, Inspector. Anything. To think of that poor girl. And my Jimmy Myers finding a body.
Mrs. Riley, can you recall offhand whether you had any registered mail for the Army unit on Monday?
Registered mail on Monday. Well, I couldn't remember offhand, Inspector, but I'll have it here in the book. Wait a minute and I'll look it up. No. No, there was nothing on Monday. There hasn't been a registered letter for the Army since last week.
Then the postal corporal wouldn't have been delayed on Monday morning.
Oh, not him. He was in for his mail bag and out again quick as you like. Didn't even stop for a chat. I remember that now.
What time would he have left here, Mrs. Riley? Can you give me any idea?
I can give it to you right on the dot. It's come back to me quite plainly. We open at 8:30. Corporal Ferris was here waiting when I arrived to open up.
8:30. And he didn't stay?
No, not more than a few minutes.
The inspector picked up Sergeant Worthington and together they drove back to the army camp. A few orders from the commanding officer and Corporal Ferris was paraded once more and his gear searched. At the bottom of his kit bag they found what they were looking for.
Here we are, sir. A battle jacket. With one button missing.
And it matches, Sergeant.
Ferris, what have you got to say about this?
That's crazy, sir. I don't know anything about it.
She was sketching, wasn't she, Ferris? She drew a pencil drawing of you, isn't that, sir?
You're bluffing. She didn't do any drawing of me. It was a landscape scene.
A landscape scene, yes, so it was. And that fact has never been mentioned in any of the papers. Only the Sergeant and I knew that, Ferris. And the killer.
Paul Ferris was taken into custody and charged with the murder of Jeanette Morgan, the swamp girl.
Silence!
Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, you have heard the facts in this case as related by the witnesses which have been called, both by the defense and the prosecution. The prisoner stands before you accused of the crime of murder, a particularly brutal murder, a murder without motive. But lack of motive is not necessarily a defense. It is for you to decide whether the facts which you have learned during this case, not only the words spoken by the witnesses, but the mute testimony of the material objects placed before you, justify your verdict, which must be beyond all reasonable doubt.
The brass button and a slip of the tongue led to his downfall. Today, that brass button occupies a place of honor in the Black Museum.
Orson Welles will be back with you in just a moment. Here, in person, is Orson Welles.
The picture was completed when the tracks of a vehicle were found some 50 yards away from the scene of the crime. The tracks were identified as those of the mail truck, of which the driver had been Corporal Paul Ferris. The defense did their utmost to prove insanity, but the jury were in little doubt that the man was sane, and that his advances repulsed, he'd strangled the swamp girl to death. They took 17 minutes to find him guilty, and the brass button which had led to his arrest was Exhibit A on the courtroom table, from where at the end of the trial and the pronouncement of the inevitable death sentence, it was taken to its present resting place in the Black Museum. And now, until we meet next time in the same place and I tell you another story about the Black Museum, I remain, as always, obediently yours.
The Black Museum, starring Orson Welles, is presented by arrangement with Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer Radio Attraction. The program is written by Creswick Jenkinson, with music composed and conducted by Sidney Torch. Produced by Harry Allen Towers.
Well, folks, that is it until next week. Hope to see you then. In the meantime, take care. And, well, bye.